Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
The 16th of July 2020 marks the 20th anniversary of the launch of CLSTR, a European Space Agency mission to learn more about how our planet's magnetic field interacts with particles streaming from the sun, known as the solar wind. For this episode, I got the chance to speak to Dr. Mike Hapgood, a space weather expert and a scientist who's been a key part of the CLSTR team since the 1990s, to find out more about this incredible mission, decades in the making.
My name's Mike Hapgood. I work at RAL Space, which is part of UK Research and Innovation, and it's at its Rutherford Appleton Laboratory, hence the RAL bit. I have done all sorts of things involved with kind of space research and the natural, basically how the sun drives various phenomena in space around the Earth and in our atmosphere and even on the ground. You might lump that as kind of the space weather, but it's partly I work on the science of space weather, and that's my involvement with the CLSTR mission. But in recent years, I've also had a big involvement in the impacts of space weather. But in talking about CLSTR, I guess I should focus on the science of space weather and the science specifically that CLSTR does. Had a long involvement in studying the Earth's magnetosphere, so the region of space around the Earth, and that's full of magnetic fields and plasma, essentially charged particles, electrons, protons, and heavy ions that move about. And there's an awful lot of dynamics in there that's driven by energy coming from the sun in the form of the solar wind. And the flow of that into the Earth's magnetosphere is very much modulated by the magnetic fields in the solar wind and by, you know, great gusts of solar wind that we call coronal mass ejections and all the business of solar activity that I probably use far too long to explain here. But what matters is that environment in the magnetosphere, important because it puts energy into the Earth's upper atmosphere, particularly polar regions. And the spectacular example of that is the aurora, which is more or less where I started in this work, like, rather too many decades ago, like over four. There's all that aspect of it. Also, but important, the magnetosphere, it's the environment in which a lot of satellites operate. And also, very important, it tells us about the fundamental physics of what happens in similar environments throughout the universe. The magnetospheres of other planets, particularly, say, Saturn and Mercury, Jupiter's moon, Ganymede, is a bit like that. Jupiter itself is a bit different because it's such a huge object and has a lot of different dynamics. But we also, there'll be similar structures in other solar systems. And so, you know, there's a very down-to-earth aspect of it. It's our Earth environment, but it also has a broader astrophysical knowledge that we gain from it.
It's all that activity that you were talking about, aurora and solar activity, coronal mass ejections. Does that all fall under the bracket of space weather? I think a lot of people might not have heard that term before. What actually is space weather?
Well, ultimately, space weather, we're concerned about how all that activity impacts our technological systems, and to some extent in terms of radiation may have an effect on human health. But it's the things you hear, all the headline stuff about the power grids going down or GPS not working properly or breakdown of radio communications out to aircraft. There's a whole host of these things that people now take very seriously. But what we're studying in the magnetosphere is a key part of the science that drives those. So if you think of it, if, say, people worry about the impacts of flooding on rivers, but you've also got people who then worry about, you know, trying to study and predict rainfall, which is a key driver of course, for flooding. It's all a very holistic thing. You've got to see how all this is joined up. It's also science that's not so much full of big, great, instant, big headline discoveries. It's this chipping away at understanding the science. You see this in atmospheric science. It's always a good analogy. You know, 50, 100 years, people have been gradually improving how we understand the atmosphere, and that feeds into better weather forecasts. So we're doing the same with the magnetosphere, the sun, etc., to make better space weather forecasts to warn when things will be disrupted.
Yeah, so are those sort of headlines and kind of worries about GPS disruptions, are they actually justified, you think?
Yes, to some extent. You could certainly have disruptions to GPS if we had a really bad big event like we had in 2003 or 1989, you'd have GPS either giving you very inaccurate positions like several miles away or just fading out completely. I wrote an article there some years ago saying it's an amazing technology, but it's also a source of risk. You know, it pays if you're using GPS. Is what your GPS is telling you make sense? Like, look around with your eyes and does it match what GPS is saying? You know, and you, in rural areas, you often hear this, drivers are all over the place because the GPS is putting them in the wrong place.
Yeah, exactly. Or like the landscape hasn't been updated on the system and there's now a road where there wasn't one.
Yes, or there's a road that actually ends up in a foot ferry rather than a bridge they can go over. That's a...
The reason we're talking today is because the 16th of July 2020 is 20 years since the launch of the Cluster mission. I was wondering if you'd just tell us a bit about what Cluster does and how you came to work on it.
Okay, what Cluster is first? Part of the idea in studying the magnetosphere is we want to try and distinguish between what's changing because something's moving, a spatial variation, or because the spacecraft's moving more than it, given the speed they move, or what's actually changing with time. So it's resolving space and time in terms of the magnetosphere. But we've recognised back as far back as 1965, one of our sadly no longer with us scientists, Jim Dungey, came up with the idea that you need four spacecraft, probably flying in a tetrahedron. That's the perfect. And that was the genesis of the idea, and it finally turned into a proposal in the 1980s, and then, as you know, the successful mission was launched 20 years ago next week.
And how did you come involved in the mission, and what has been your role throughout those 20 years?
Okay. I came to mission, it was just timing. I was at the right stage in my career when one of our then senior scientists working with ESA spotted that somebody needed to coordinate science operations, and they gave our laboratory, RAL, the contract to do that. And we built this thing called the Joint Science Operations Centre, and I was just at the right place at the right time and have spent 27 years doing that. And I'm the sort of project scientist, so have to understand how the system works, but also under the science and try to bring the two together. I've now actually passed on as project scientist as I'm sort of on the way to retirement, but still keeping a finger in and helping them. But over those years, a lot of that's been actually just making the science operations systems work and being the voice of science, linking the engineering to the science. And it's been a lovely community to work with because it's a very collaborative community. Everybody has worked together. The science drives that. The science comes from everybody working together, not from somebody running off with one data and making a big story out of it.
Yeah, I'm sure I can imagine it must just be a complete collaborative effort with all the different disciplines and specialities coming together to make a mission like this work.
Yeah, there are 11 instruments on each of four spacecraft, so there's 44 instruments in total, all to be coordinated, and that's the job we do. And when we started building it, we found that there was a great disparity in the way the scientists wanted to run their instruments. So having scratched our heads a while, and we then had to go away and design a system that could cope with that disparity. That could, you know, some people had very simple systems that we could almost automate it, and that we could just send them a draft of what was to be done, and they would give it a quick once over and say yes. And in fact, lately, when they're confident, someone would say, "I'm going on holiday," and they pre-approve things. So we could run those instruments comfortably. But other instruments required a lot of detailed attention, a lot of loving care to make them work very well. And so with those, we basically give them an empty frame, and then they put in what they need to do. So we have this, I think, I'm very pleased to have played a major part in designing that. And the proof of the pudding is it's worked well for 20 years. You know, this is relentless. Since we started in January of 2001, we started preparing the commanding. We've basically worked it every week. We have a weekly cycle every week, apart from we do every December, we do shuffle up a bit and try and do 3 weeks in four, so everybody has Christmas week off.
It was initially just supposed to run for 2 years, wasn't it?
The original design criterion we had was to build a mission for 2 years. That's what we were told back in 1993 when we started doing the design work. And now it's 20 years on.
What was the reason for that extension? Is it just a case of it still works, so why not keep using it?
I think it's more that once you start discovering the science, there's lots of exciting science. When we started the mission, first of all, we only recorded for 50% of the orbit. And 50% of the orbit, we took no data. And everybody said that, well, there's definitely a need for a change. Let's take data all around the orbit. And ESA found the capacity to take data down from the spacecraft. We had to adapt our systems to record all around the orbit because we designed it for discrete lumps here and there on the orbit. And now we had to make sure each orbit was a discrete lump, but we make sure we stitch up the boundaries so everything runs smoothly across the boundaries. And so we put that in place in 2003. And since then, a big thing that's driving the science also is the orbit changes a lot. It started off with this big elliptical orbit going out about a third of the way to the moon. And, you know, four spacecraft are all relatively close together, but coming down to about 20,000 kilometers altitude. But the orbit, it's very sensitive to the sun and the moon's effects, the same forces that drive the tides in the sea. And the orbit's changed, it's twisted around, it's grown, it's grown. Back in 2012, we got one spacecraft down to a 250-kilometer altitude and then started rising again. And the spacecraft have now reached a maximum and they're gradually coming down. I think first spacecraft just is now getting below 25,000 kilometers altitude. That sounds very safe. In 4 years' time, it's going to re-enter the atmosphere as the perigee drops. And then the others will follow in the following years. So the mission will come to a very definite end. One spacecraft in 24, one in 25, and two in 26. Yeah, and then these will be breathe a sigh of relief because they don't have to worry about it running into hitting anything else. You know, spacecraft collisions are a big issue these days. And at times, they used to have had to keep a close eye on where cluster is going and have the capacity to fire. They have the thrusters on it they could fire to maneuver to make sure they don't get too close to another spacecraft.
Yeah, if it's orbiting Earth, is there any danger of it, for example, coming into contact with other artificial satellites or the International Space Station, or is it far too far away from our planet to actually?
I think that's a big thing for space for the people in operating space operations. They do keep a very careful eye on these, and they have programs that will check where it's going. Is it going to get within, say, 20 kilometers of another object? I can't remember the exact. So I'm just guessing 20. But once they start seeing those, they will keep a close eye on it and maybe do them. And the clusters still have their full maneuvering capability. Not much fuel, but it don't take much to just change that miss distance if you spot it a few weeks ahead.
That's absolutely incredible that it still has fuel. I mean, it's
a few kilos.
That must have added a lot of weight to the payload on launch. I mean,
that was part of some of the fuel was required to get to the final orbit. The launchers didn't put them in the final orbit, and that was a lot. But a lot of fuel was needed. We want to check, because we have the four spacecraft, we want to change the arrangement of the spacecraft, change the separations of them. You know, some cases, the ESA have managed to bring them down to a few kilometers. By the time they've been 20,000, depending on the science, you keep. There was recently, we've had one where I call the tail end Charlie mode, where one of the spacecraft one is actually trailing the others. So as the other spacecraft come into the Earth's magnetosphere, it's monitoring what the solar wind is doing immediately upstream. And yeah, it's an idea a Swedish colleague of mine proposed a few years ago, and I'm delighted to see it's been done.
Fantastic. What is the need for four different spacecraft, and do the four different spacecraft have specifically different functions, or are they all kind of operating on the same level?
Generally, we operate them the same way. The reason for the four is to get that separation of time and space when we see signals on the different spacecraft and compare them. With four, we can completely resolve what's changing with time and what is changing with spatial position. And there's a whole set of colleagues who've developed all kinds of mathematical tools for doing this, which I certainly don't want to go into now because I'd have to remind myself. But yeah, the spacecraft, we try to run them identically where we are. The system is designed to do that as a primer, but we can do differences where we need to. For instance, when they get very spread out, then they all pass through the perigee region at different times. So we have to do different things there to protect them from the radiation belts and put the instruments in modes that are appropriate for the radiation belts and not something that's too sensitive and would be a problem.
Mm. 20 years is a long time in a space mission and for the advancement of technology. Mm. Are there things that you wish, you know, that we have now that we didn't have 20 years ago that you wish were on board the cluster?
Yes, absolutely. But of course, the mission was designed in the late 1980s. So the technology is probably 30 years old. The big thing these days is to do better time resolution. Now, the Americans have a mission called Magnetospheric Multiscale that is like Cluster and is doing very high time resolution at very small separations. So, in fact, now rather that we don't, it's not so much a competition, it's a collaboration. So they will be doing this very fine timescale stuff because they have a more modern mission. But then to look at the bigger picture, we collaborate between the American missions and Cluster. So we can see what's happening on the large scale in the magnetosphere, and they look at the small scale. One of the big, I think, the one big ticket discovery, I would say, over the last 20 years is understanding we have to look at all these scales at the same time. Because things happening at, say, a very small scale of a few kilometres can be affecting what's happening at a 1,000-kilometre scale, and that can then be affecting actually what's almost happening globally throughout the magnetosphere. And it's putting all that together is the big challenge.
Mm. Yeah, in terms of discoveries, what have been the big scientific breakthroughs from Cluster? What have the scientists actually learned?
I think there's all sorts of things, and that's why I was saying it's more understanding that the issue about the scales is the thing I would always highlight. Beyond that, there's all sorts of details of different regions. It's a bit invidious to try and pick things out, but we've explored the generation of the aurora. You know, some textbooks say the aurora is electrons coming from the sun. That's generally nonsense. Most of it is they're actually energized 10 to 20,000 kilometers above the Earth's surface in what we call the auroral acceleration region. It's obvious and not very enthralling, but it does the job. And it's trying to understand what happens there. It generates the energetic electrons that produce the aurora. Also generates a huge amount of radio signals that you could probably be able to detect them at Proxima Centauri. They're so powerful. Yeah, that's why some radio astronomers want to go and hide on the back of the moon if they can work at those low frequencies. You can't see these things from the ground. The ionosphere blocks them. But if you wanted to observe the universe at those frequencies, but going on the far side of the moon would be a good place to be. Mm. Hide from the aurora.
In terms of sort of future missions, are you following closely the developments of the solar orbiter?
I have. Well, some of my colleagues have a spectrometer instrument on that, and we're hearing what they're doing, and just keeping an eye on it. And they've now, I think, pretty much finished the commissioning of the instruments and going through the first perihelion pass. That's a great work, yeah. And so looking forward to see what the results are. But I first was introduced to the idea 23 years ago. These things take a long time. And, the big thing is, therefore, to sit above the sun's surface, and so you can observe the same region and then continuously see what's coming out, rather than just get little snapshots. And that's really fascinating to do that science.
Do you think it would be beneficial to put spacecraft like Cluster around a different planet of the solar system known to have aurora and do the same science but around a different planet?
Yeah. Yeah. I think somebody did plan to. I have seen a proposal wants to do something at Mars, and Mars has aurora. We don't see them very well, but we've certainly seen Mars Express, for instance, I think has seen the electrons and even seen some of the emissions from Martian aurora. And just basically have send a mother spaceship with a few small spaceships, CubeSats, and then deploy them at Mars, send them around, and then they would send back to the mother spaceship, which then has the main radio link back to Earth.
Is that a mission that you could sort of see yourself getting involved with if you weren't sort of winding down the current Cluster mission?
Oh yeah. if for a younger person, yes. All right. It's going to take a long time. It's not my career now. I think I'll be just watching from the sidelines doing small jobs as I get older and older. It's a fascinating thing. I think the thing with the CubeSats is getting the technology robust and reliable enough. And there's lots of people working on that. And even going back to the Earth's magnetosphere, we would like to do that. Because what we would really like to do is fly 12 spacecraft in formation so we can get different spatial scales at the same time. And there was a proposal to do that called cross-scale. It was, I think, judged too expensive with current technologies. And it's the technology that is going to help drive that forward.
I suppose one of the benefits also of studying the sun is that it's an opportunity to study a star. You know, it's the closest star that we can get to. So does Cluster kind of provide much in the way of actual stellar science?
Not really, because what we're looking at is what the star does to our planet. But of course, there is directly an analogy of what would happen to a similar Earth-like planet around another star. So I was saying with the radio emissions from the aurora that Cluster studies, because we have the radio receivers on all four spacecraft that work, and they're working at a few hundreds of kilohertz typically. So it's the old medium wave radio that I grew up with many years ago. Those frequencies. If we could observe more distantly, similar emissions from distant stars, that would start to tell us, ooh, that planet's got a magnetic field, and maybe infer things about whether it's potentially lifelike. Yeah, so there's quite a lot of work being done, articles written on using these radio emissions from distant stars to see what we see from on Earth. I should say there's also similar emissions from Saturn and Jupiter. So it's not these things have been known for quite a while. In fact, I think the Jupiter ones were found first because they actually can get through the ionosphere.
Ah, right.
So they were found in the 50s, and the terrestrial ones were only found in the 1960s for when we had spacecraft up above the ionosphere.
In terms of Cluster, what's left then? If there's only a few years left on the mission, are there any more milestones to kind of?
Oh yes, there's quite a lot because of the orbit changing. There are lots of things we want to go back to the auroral zone in a few years' time and actually make more measurements there. Working with the American missions, we can do these kind of what we call multi-scale studies, as we were talking about before, looking at first of all at the magnetopause and then at the Earth's bow shock. So there's a shock wave in front of the Earth that deflects the solar wind, and then the magnetopause is the boundary between the solar wind and the magnetosphere. And you know, if we're lucky, we might also overlap with a new ESA mission called SMILE, which is designed to take pictures of the magnetosphere by imaging it in X-rays. There's an X-ray emission at the boundary of the Earth's magnetosphere, and SMILE is designed to image that. Now, if the timing works out right, those images will come in, and we'll be able to, at the same time, you'll have clusters sort of providing a kind of ground truth by passing through the magnetopause at the same time.
Absolutely fascinating. And presumably also there's lots of data that scientists haven't really got around to looking at yet because they're concerned with the actual day-to-day workings of the mission. So
there's lots of young scientists and other scientists doing it. There's been almost 3,000 papers written on cluster data. So yeah, there's an awful lot of data being, but part of the idea is also to preserve the data because, you know, it's a mission like this. You might expect it to be used for another 50 years. You know, we're still doing that. We're talking yesterday in some discussions about some data that was taken around 1970 is important for a problem that we want to look at.
Absolutely fascinating. Mike, thanks very much for speaking to me today. I just want to say good luck with the rest of the mission, and we're really interested to see the science that comes out of Cluster over the coming decades.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Bateman and Ben Hewitt. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast or Spotify.